is the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, liberty, and peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. We got so much to cover today. Congressman Peter DeFazio is going to drop by in our third hour. GMO labeling, the weirdness of our transportation system, the eternal weirdness of Republicans. Joe Madison will be here. He's going to drop by the studio for our second hour on the whole issue of Eric Garner and Black Lives Matter and what's going on. And right now, Mike Papantonio is with us, America's lawyer and host of Ring of Fire Radio. Pap, welcome back to the program. It's great to have you with us.
Tom, how are you?
I'm great, and I'm always pleased to have you on. As an attorney, you understand what grand juries are and how they work and all this kind of stuff. Can you explain to me why it is that in Ferguson and in New York City that the prosecuting attorney presented before a grand jury essentially the defense when, if I have this right, Antonin Scalia in a 1992 opinion, Supreme Court opinion, said, and I quote, "It is the grand jury's function not to inquire upon which foundation the charge may be denied or otherwise to try to the suspect's defenses, but only to examine upon the foundation, what foundation the charge is made by the prosecutor." It seems like when there's a cop involved, these prosecutors flip their functions upside down.
Well, that's right. I mean, that's why the grand jury has become so irrelevant nowadays in cases like this. There's a term you've heard called the thin blue line. We've heard it from Joseph Wahlberg talked about it a long time ago. And
it was a book title.
Exactly. Serpico. You may remember the story about Serpico.
Yep.
Go back and look at this if you have any doubt that this exists. But what it is prosecutors and judges and policemen have a direct interest in protecting prosecutors and judges and policemen on issues like this. It's an inherent part of the system that, unfortunately, there's no sign of it changing. You simply can't change the way that a grand jury reacts to a prosecutor. If you see the pattern here, it's almost inescapable, Tom. First of all, you start off with a pattern that about 99% of the time, the prosecutor is going to get exactly what he wants. In these two cases where policemen were involved, he did not. In these two cases, he did a dump where he simply puts in all of the information and then says at the end of it, "Oh, golly gee, I'm going to show you all of this and you can make a decision for yourself." And then you read the data, you read the transcript, as I'm sure you took a look at in Ferguson, and we all did. And you understand as you read it that you can't really tell what's going on there because there's so many nods and winks and emphasis and de-emphasis taking place. So what you do is you bring in the forensic expert that you want. And that forensic expert typically always works with the police department. Their career depends on the police department. They have to say what the police department wants. That happened in the Garner case, and that happened in Ferguson as well. And it happens all of the time. I mean, this is not just a sometimes. And the DA did exactly what the DA always does in a cop case, and that is not to really pitch the idea of an indictment, but to put up their hands and say, "Oh, golly gee, y'all are smarter than me," and in the process hustle the grand jury when they don't even know they're being hustled. The hustle was so bad in Garner, as a matter of fact, that you had the coroner come back and say, "Yeah, this is clearly homicide." If I can take a minute to explain why, Tom,
please.
I'd be glad to do that if you want to talk about this.
Please.
It's impossible to analyze the facts without understanding why the chokehold, for example, was banned off limits, not only in New York, but in law enforcement organizations around the country. In fact, the only time an officer is permitted to use a chokehold is when his life is in danger. There are about a half a dozen other types of body-to-body restraints that are more effective. In New York, even after the ban was put in place, civilian complaint board, showed 200 reports per chokehold every year, much more than that, but those were the ones that's reported. It's important to understand, Tom, why the coroner came out and said what he said. It's important to understand how violently dangerous the chokehold is. Usually it's not done properly. It crushes about 6 inches of the one pipe when it's not done properly, which obviously cuts off a steady flow of oxygen to the brain. In addition to that, it often closes the carotid artery that supplies blood to the brain. In fact, the hold is not done, when it's not done properly, has the potential to tear the carotid artery along with crushing the windpipe. Add to that continuing complicating factors such as respiratory impairment from things such as COPD or asthma or blood flow restrictions, and all these problems become predictable and people die needlessly. Now here, the reason all of that is important is the coroner saw all of that. You see, the pitch from the right wing is, oh, gee whiz, it was the weight of these people on this man's body. He was face down, and the weight crushed his lungs, and he couldn't get his breath. It was the combination of all of that. And there certainly was enough to get to a jury. As a matter of law, this grand jury should not be permitted to say, oh, gee, there's no probable cause here. Look, when you have a knee-jerk nut like Scalia trying to explain that the grand jury is only something, it's only preliminary question, should a jury hear this? When you have a guy like Scalia saying that, you understand how badly this has been bastardized, not just in the Gardner case, but also in Ferguson.
Well, and presumably for decades, if not centuries.
Oh, absolutely. You know, these aren't repetitively, one thing about this, Tom, the reason they banned this process, and the chokehold is what we, you know, every time a police officer murders another citizen, we get something that should be talked about. And the chokehold is something we should talk about. These aren't repetitively trained officers who get refresher courses and maneuvers like this on this chokehold. They get training at the academy. That's it. But truthfully, it would have made no difference here what the coroner said, because in the actual hearing, what the grand jury heard was forensic experts that the DA paraded through because they were handpicked. They were police-friendly pathologists who make their living. They can't eat unless they come out and testify exactly for what the police want. They can't get the cases in court. The DA can't win in court without the police officers. So the grand jury process should be limited to that one question, and that is, should a full-fledged jury hear all the facts? Should they be subject to cross-examination when they're on the stand if it's a forensic expert? Should we be able to have a jury do what a jury's supposed to do, and that's get to the truth here? And this bastardization of the process is making it clear that in these settings, a grand jury is almost irrelevant.
I've been trying to come up with an analogy or a metaphor for this that is both simple and explanatory that people might be able to run with. The one that comes to mind, although it's still too convoluted, I'm still trying to get my hands around this, is people reporting harassment in the workplace, sexual harassment, or just an employer who's, you know, treating them badly. You know, very often people don't report that because they don't want to go up against everybody in their workplace. And as a consequence, a lot of horrible stuff happens, and et cetera, just because people want to get along. They want to keep their job and they want to keep their relationships. Isn't the prosecutor's role with the grand jury, with the police, very similar to that?
It's exactly that. This is the only people who ignore this white elephant sitting in the living room are law and order nuts who don't understand that part of law and order is that you can't have anarchy within the enforcement arm of law and order. They're going to reject the common sense is there. I mean, the grand jury system becomes gamed, it becomes hustled, it becomes rigged according to the political wishes or the political ambition of freaks like this particular DA. The inherent conflict of interest are overwhelming. The legal infrastructure in place everywhere is there to protect cops. The Supreme Court, for example, in a series of rulings as far back as the 1980s, gave police a green light by telling them that the total decision-making about using deadly force came down to whether the officer's subjective belief is that his or another officer's life is threatened, not by death, but even simply by injury. It's called objective reasonableness.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Bastardized.
Yeah, amazing stuff. Mike Papantonio, America's Lawyer, ringoffireradio.com is the website. We'll be right back. And welcome back. Mike Papantonio is still on the line with us. Tell us about the Ring of Fire TV coming up this Sunday at noon Eastern time and replaying through the week here on Free Speech TV, Pap.
Well, this week we'll have author Thomas Frank. He's going to explain the myth of the center and why Democrats need to avoid moving this towards this non-existent area of politics. Howard Nation's going to tell us why some of the biggest corporations in America are paying their CEOs more than they pay in taxes. We have blogger Chauncey DeVega is going to tell us why there's no justice for Michael Brown's family. And attorney Karen, we're going to have several attorneys going to explain why it's so difficult to prosecute police officers, as we're talking about now, even when the evidence against them is overwhelming. Michael Berg is going to tell us why wage theft by employers is undermining any efforts we make to correct minimum wage problems in this country.
That sounds like a
great show. It's a diversity of topics, and of course we'll have to touch on this issue of Gardner, and it's simply a repeat of Ferguson.
Yeah.
In many ways, much worse.
And stuff that seems to be happening, way too frequently and throughout for a long, long time here in the United States. Meanwhile, Antonio Weiss has been nominated by President Obama to be number what, 2, 3, 4, something like that in the Treasury Department.
Yeah. Yeah. The discussion about that is, again, it's a common sense discussion. Weiss is a guy that the company, he's working for a company, Lessard, and they want to pay him $20 million for taking a job with the government. Now you ask, why would a corporation want to pay this guy to go to work as the top guy in Treasury? Well, I mean, does it really take any analysis to tell you why? The answer is because when he gets there, he does all of the favors for Wall Street. This is the guy Wall Street wants. So they actually pay him $20 million to take the job with the government. And then when you have people like Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren complaining about it and saying, how ridiculous, how stupid have we become? They call that the populist shakedown. That is simply a bunch of mealy-mouthed populists talking about the idea of there being something wrong with paying a government official at the very top of the game $20 million before they go to work with the government. We saw the same thing happen with Stefan Selig. He was paid $9 million by the Bank of America right before he went to his post at the Department of Commerce. We saw the same thing with Michael Froman. He was paid $4 million by his company before he went to work with the U.S. Trade as a U.S. Trade Representative. So the question is, why do you pay these guys these millions of dollars when they're leaving? You know, they're going to work for the government. And the reason you do it is because they then have a troll inside government for them.
Right.
They have somebody that's doing exactly what they want.
And we saw this with the USDA and the FDA back during the first Bush administration when they were approving GMOs, where people from Monsanto kept moving into and out of government. It's pretty astonishing. This is regulatory capture, isn't it?
Well, it's beyond regulatory capture. Regulatory capture simply used to be when you'd have conversations with the person that's supposed to be regulating and say, hey, Joe, how would you like a job when you leave here? That was kind of more regulatory capture. And now they've taken it to a whole new height. It's regulatory ownership. It used to be capture. We're just going to grab somebody every now and then. But now when you get the guys at the very top, you're going to own the entire regulatory process that takes place day to day.
It is full-blown crazy. Mike Papantonio, always great seeing you, Pap. Thanks for dropping by.
Thank you.
Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you, 20 minutes past the hour. I mentioned there's a lot going on today. But this prosecutor Michael Donovan in New York, Staten Island, I guess, the borough, deciding to do essentially the same thing that Bob McCullough did in Ferguson, which is present the defense for the police officer to the grand jury at the same time that you're presenting what might be prosecution evidence, has a lot of people. Has a lot of people, you know, really outraged and deeply so and appropriately so. And this is why back, you know, a couple of weeks ago I lose track of time, but, a while ago when the Michael Brown non-verdict or non-indictment came down, there was, of course, this move to say, and in fact, the Michael Brown family calling for body cameras on cops. Well, you know, number one, here we have actual video of the murder of this fellow. You know, Eric Garner's murder is on videotape. including after he has stopped breathing and is unconscious and is presumably well on his way to dead, yet he has just stopped breathing. The cops roll him over, and nobody decides to try CPR on him. I mean, that's mind-boggling to me. So anyhow, my point was that, you know, the body cameras is, you know, arguably a nice first step. We've, you know, we've seen this with the dash cams and police cars. I think if you're going to do that, you have to put some teeth into it. You have to say that if a police officer's body camera did not record an incident where a police officer is being charged with a crime, the police officer is no longer entitled to the presumption of innocence. Which is how it works when you refuse a breathalyzer when you're pulled over by the police right now. If you say, no, I'm not going to blow into that tube or whatever, that contraption, then you are presumed guilty and you must demonstrate your innocence. And if a police officer says, no, I don't have video of my interaction with that guy, he's presumed guilty and he has to demonstrate his innocence. This would go a long way, you know, in number one, toward encouraging the use of cameras, but two, you know, cleaning up some of the stuff in our criminal justice system. So, A, I pointed that out, but, you know, I said, you know, the body cameras aren't a panacea. They aren't going to solve all the problems. What are some of the things we should be looking at? Well, number one, and this has been my rant from day one, it's crazy that a prosecutor who literally depends on the police department to do his job every single day, and if the cops are PO'd at this prosecutor and they start, you know, testifying in ways that can throw cases for him and his conviction rate starts collapsing, he's not going to be a prosecutor very much longer. I mean, this isn't just like, you know, relying on your, you know, not ratting out your fellow people at work because, you know, somebody treated you poorly or spoke badly. This goes way beyond that. I mean, the police actually have the power simply by, you know, when they get up on the stand saying, well, I think I saw that. Boom, the case just blows up, right? And if a prosecutor suddenly has hostile police, he's going to lose his job. So he's got to be on the side of the cops. And therefore, the prosecutor and the grand jury, who also, you know, work hand in glove with the police, they should not be investigating each other. The prosecutor or the grand jury should not be investigating the police. There needs to be an independent special prosecutor appointed from out of town before a group of citizens who are not on an ongoing day-to-day relationship with the police. Whenever a police officer is charged with a crime, or whenever at the very least, I mean, this is the very highest bar, at the very least, whenever anybody dies at the hands of police. But I would go beyond that. I would say whenever a civilian, whenever a citizen asserts that a police officer or a police department, I mean, there were a number of cops involved in the takedown of Eric Garner here, who arguably are all guilty of homicide. Or participating in homicide. If you participate in a crime, you are, and even though you're not the guy who pulled the trigger or did the chokehold, you're still part of the guilty, you know, you and three. If you drive the getaway car for somebody who robs a bank and kills the bank guard in the process, you can be prosecuted for murder, even though you never got out of the car. So, you know, this concept is pretty straightforward. And by the way, here's the ultimate irony. And this was over at what website? Oh, it's Raw Story. Raw Story published this. Here, the headline says it all. New York Police Department cop, NYPD cop, who choked Eric Garner was not indicted, but the man who recorded the incident, the guy who videotaped it, he was indicted. The grand jury presented an indictment for him. They said he had an unloaded gun. And that he had stuffed it inside the waistband of a 17-year-old to get rid of it. He says that they trumped this up in retaliation for his videotaping these cops killing this young man, this father of six. We got to do something about this. And frankly, white people and white liberals have been too silent on this for too long. You know, life is comfortable for white people in this country, by and large. It's white privilege. So on the conservative side, you've got conservatives who they just don't like change. They're sitting around going, hey, you know, let's not upset the apple cart. Things are fine the way they are. And then you got liberals on the other side going, well, it doesn't seem so bad to me. White liberals who live in a white world, by and large, don't, you know, they just don't. So we all need to wake the hell up. Speaking to white people in this country, we all need to wake up. We'll be back. 28 minutes past.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
This is just absolutely unacceptable. I got some amazing statistics I'll share with you, and we'll pick up your phone calls after the break. The bad and the very, very oscillatedly ugly. The good. Tom Colocchio, the Top Chef star, was one of a group of 700 chefs and restaurant owners who on Tuesday delivered a petition to lawmakers on Capitol Hill asking them to support the labeling of GMO foods. That petition, which was sponsored by Barbara Boxer of California in the Senate and Peter DeFazio of Oregon in the House, reads as follows. As chefs, we know that choosing the right ingredients is an absolutely critical part of cooking. But when it comes to whether our ingredients contain genetically modified organisms, we're in the dark. Simple truth is, consumers have a right to know what they're feeding their families. And as chefs, we have a right to know what we're feeding our customers. End of quote. Couldn't agree more. It's good to see that chefs are sticking up for our right to know. Let's just hope that Congress is listening. The bad. Steve Doocy. During a discussion about citizenship tests on Wednesday's episode of Fox and Friends, the Fox so-called news host suggested that the government should start using tests to determine if people are fit to do things like, you know, vote. Check it out.
Listen, not only, okay, you've got to answer those questions correctly to become a citizen of the United States. I think not only would it be great if high school students had to have a proficiency in America, but I think they should have a test before you vote. Just so you know what
not
you're
bad.
Voting
great.
On. Not bad. Right?
Not bad, right. We already tried this whole testing people thing before they vote. And, Steve, it was called Jim Crow. It didn't work out all that well, so I don't think that's a good idea. And a very, very ugly Robert Keller, Utah resident, was sentenced to 1 year in prison Monday for threatening to kill his 13-year-old African-American neighbor. After Keller saw that neighbor walking down the street with a white girl, he wrote this letter to the neighbor's family. Quote, there's no little black girls to go out with, so our daughters are in line. I'll catch that N-word around my daughter. I'll kill him and then go find what stupid person brought him here in the first place. End of quote. As if that wasn't bad enough, Keller then apparently tried to pass his threatening remarks off as some sort of lesson, telling the court before his sentencing that all he wanted to do was, quote, wake his neighbors up to what was going to happen down the road. End quote. Right. I don't know what's worse, the fact that Keller actually threatened to kill a teenager for walking with someone of a different race, or the fact that he doesn't seem to understand why doing so was a big deal. That is very, very important. Okay, I said I'd share some statistics with you. By the way, this piece over at thedailybanter.com, Ben Cohen's website, the author of the piece, Bob Seska, starts out by pointing out that a Twitter friend of his noted that James Holmes, the guy who walked into the Aurora, Colorado movie theater and wounded 70 people, shot and killed 12 people, he was taken alive. So, white guy goes into a theater with, you know, 100 rounds of ammunition or thereabouts or more and shoots 70 people, killing 12 of them. He's taken alive. Black guy's selling cigarettes on the street at 50 cents a pop. He gets taken down dead. So what does this tell us? This is a great article by Bob Seska. He just, you know, goes through a whole list of things here that, and you know, the right-wing argument, the Bill O'Reilly argument, the Joe Scarborough argument is, well, there's more crime in black neighborhoods, so therefore you're going to have more police interactions, and therefore you're going to have more bad outcomes like that. Well, okay, if you if you want to go down that road, number one, we have to ask the question, if there's more crime, why? Number two, could it be that there's more reported crime, but there's not actually more crime? There's actually far more crime going on in white neighborhoods. I mean, it was the banksters who have been responsible for literally millions, white banksters, who have been responsible for literally millions of Americans losing their homes, for divorces, for spousal abuse, for, you know, suicides, homicides, no doubt. Nobody is defining that as a crime wave, right? But it's not even, you know, you don't even have to go to the level of banksters to look at this thing. Here's some of the number. He points out, first of all, young inner-city African-American men, they get convicted more often. Could it be that the reason why is because they're less capable of affording good defense lawyers? And therefore, they get convicted more often than white suburban men from the suburbs. For example, as Bob Seska notes, five times as many whites as blacks reportedly use and sell illegal drugs, yet blacks are incarcerated for drug offenses 10 times more often than whites for the same offenses. Why? Prison sentences for blacks are 10% longer than for whites. Prosecutors seek minimum mandatories for black suspects 21% more frequently than for whites. Blacks are 20% more likely to be convicted of any crime than a white person. The Justice Department reported that blacks and Hispanics, I'm still reading from Bob Seska's piece for thedailybanter.com. The Justice Department reported that blacks and Hispanics are far more likely to be searched during traffic stops, three times more likely, while police officers are four times more likely to use force. That's 400%. Four times, 400% more likely. Likewise, blacks are also three times more likely, 300% more. We're not talking about a 10% difference or a 20%. 300% more likely than whites to be arrested during traffic stops. Back in 2005, the Department of Justice looked at 80,000 cases of traffic stops across the country. And they said that even though whites represent 70% of the American population, and probably even a higher percentage of that of drivers, right? The DOJ didn't note this, but I'd say probably whites represent, if they're 70% of the population, whites are probably 80% of the drivers. Yet they're only stopped 9% of the time. That we have rigged African American neighborhoods for poverty. And, you know, multi-generational poverty. This, where's the headline on this thing? Here we go. Michelle Alexander. She wrote The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness. She says, there are more African-American men in prison and jail or on probation and parole than there were slaves at the start of the Civil War. It's like we've just, you know, we've come up with a new legal category. But it's still a variation on slavery by any other name. And you have these black neighborhoods that are rigged for poverty. I mean, look at people coming back from World War II. My dad came back from World War II, a white guy. He could use the GI Bill to buy a house in any neighborhood he wanted. If he'd been black when he came back from World War II, right up until the mid-60s, and in many communities up until the mid-80s, banks were practicing redlining. They were saying, no, you know, if you're black, we're not gonna write a mortgage for that house. And towns and communities had redlining laws. If you're black, you can't live in this community. We used to live in Atlanta. Louise and I moved to Atlanta back in 1983, and we lived there for 10, 12 years, something like that, raised our kids there pretty much. We actually lived in the northern suburbs, in the white suburbs, in Marietta and in, Alpharetta? No, Roswell. We lived in Marietta and Roswell. And one of the stories that I heard from a friend of mine who was on the city council in Atlanta about why there are 38 Peachtree Streets in Atlanta. It's a big joke. Everybody, you know, anybody who's ever been to Atlanta, they say, I'm going to the corner of Peachtree and Peachtree. because there's 38 Peachtree Streets or more. Why is that? Well, it turns out that right up until the 1960s, I mean, literally from the early 1800s until the 1960s, there was a law on the books in Atlanta that said that no person of color, no African-American could walk, live, or work on Peachtree Street. It was a way of saying this is a white-only neighborhood. And so every time as Atlanta grew and suburbs became city, those suburbs or those neighborhoods wanted to define themselves as white. The way they did that is they ran a Peachtree Street right through the middle. I mean, this has been playing out across the South, not just, you know, with Peachtree Streets, but there's all these techniques and technologies and, you know, banksterisms. And I mean, Elizabeth Warren says the game is rigged. Americans get it. Right? Well, white working class Americans are starting to figure out that 34 years of Reaganomics was not just pointed at poor people, were, you know, the bottom end of the working class and people of color and union members. It was also pointed at them. It's like, welcome to the world. Welcome to conservative America. So it's time, you know, if we're gonna take a step back from Reaganomics and we're gonna take a step forward into a country that works for everybody, let's make sure this time that it's actually everybody, everybody. We got a lot of work to do in this regard. And frankly, you know, white people being 70% of the population in the United States, having the vast majority of the wealth in this country, having the vast majority of the power in this country, the political and economic power in this country. White people need to recognize what white privilege is, what life is like for African Americans in this country on a daily basis, and participate in the process of cleaning up our police departments, cleaning up our laws, and frankly, cleaning up our economy so it works for everybody.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Anyhow, I was going to take your calls. I went off on a rant, so we're going to get back to your calls. Right. Welcome back. Kenyatta, watching Free Speech TV in Redlands, California. Hey, Kenyatta, what's on your mind today?
Hello, Tom. Well, there's a lot on my mind, and I know I've got a limited amount of time to speak to you. One of the things that is really profound in your, as you termed it, rant a few minutes ago, is you were giving some statistics. And coinciding with that is I think a lot of people aren't aware that up until 1961, black police officers could not arrest white people in this country. So you
nationwide?
Nationwide.
What was the basis for that?
It was all part of the Jim Crow kind of apartheid system that still exists in this country. We have to remember that the word police comes from the word policy. It is the policy of this country to do for this to happen. That's why it keeps happening. And until white people, it's going to take white people, really, to not sit back and, you know, twiddle their thumbs and say, oh, boy, that's terrible. Right. You know, until white people get involved, nothing is going to change, because by their silence, they are co-conspirators to this. Let me tell you this.
I agree.
In the 70s, we had a police chief. I know you are aware of him, Tom, by name of an infamous police chief by the name of here in Los Angeles, by the name of Daryl Gates.
Oh, yeah.
Black men were dying left and right from the chokehold. Ultimately, it was outlawed by the L.A. Police Department as a result of these men dying. What Daryl Gates said at the time was that the reason, it wasn't that the chokehold was being applied just to black men, but they were somehow, we were somehow anatomically deformed, and that's why we were dying at a higher rate. This is part of policy. This stuff's happening in broad daylight. If you talk about Emmett Till or the civil rights workers back in the 60s that were murdered, these things normally took, even lynchings, took place at night, and there was, you know, kind of cloak and dagger kind of thing. This stuff, it's almost like these folks are thumbing their nose at black people in this country. And yeah, as a black man, I have to tell you that, you know, I am triangulating all of this stuff. It's not just, you know, because Trayvon Martin wasn't killed by a police officer, but he was killed by a white man who pretty much got away with it.
Yep.
Jordan Davis wasn't killed by a police officer. You know, there is a cheapness of black life in this country that has me very worried. And I think about the 8 Ebola cases in this country. Of those eight cases, 25% of them were black males. Of that 25%, 100% of them died. Hey, maybe I'm paranoid, but just because I'm paranoid doesn't mean they're not really after me. This right. is the last thing I want to say, Tom.
Sure.
When is the last time a black police officer killed a white child or killed a white man and got away with it? That's what I want to know. So when I hear...
Well, apparently one happened someplace like in Utah or something, and the right, because the right-wing talk show hosts are all over this. You know, where's the outrage about the white kid being getting killed by the black cop out in Utah? I don't know the details of it, but, you know, I know that I've got one conservative caller on the board who wants to point it out. You know, it's...
Well, that's one out of how many times have we gone... I mean, this is like the movie Groundhog Day. One more thing, Tom. Let me just say this to you. I posted a blog on our community called The Quiet Riot. I'd like for our folks to take a look at it. But, you know, at the end of the day in this country, we have to do what our conscience commands and our courage allows.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Very well said. I thought there was a punchline to that, but I guess that is the punchline, and it's very well said. Kenyatta, thank you very much for the call. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. We'll be right back. Before the hour, welcome back, Margie in Wisconsin Rapids. Welcome to the program, Margie. What's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. Two things regarding the non-indictment. Number one is I've been listening to a lot of reporting, and it seems like the conservative meme is now that the victim was responsible for his own death.
Right, because he was too fat.
They are saying, well, if he hadn't been obese, if he hadn't had asthma, and if he hadn't had heart disease, he would still be alive.
Right.
I've heard that from a politician. I believe it was Peter King.
Yeah, Republican congressman from New York, yeah.
And I also heard it on a commentator at Fox so-called News, which they are still, of course, playing in all the truck stops.
Yep.
The other thing is that whereas the other news stations are playing the video and the audio of the victim saying that I can't breathe, Fox News is simply showing and still photos instead of the video.
Hmm. Yeah, Fox has developed a whole mini industry stoking white outrage and pandering to white racists. It's truly astonishing. Margie, thanks for the call and pointing that out. Dan in Great Lakes, Illinois. Hey, Dan, what's up?
Hello, Tom. Once again, God bless you for the work that you do. No one's talking about Clive and Bundy in the Southwest, where a man was photoed on his stomach with a high-powered rifle and a scope trained on federal agents. He was not detained, questioned, or even shot at, as far as I know.
Right.
And then we hear this from Peter King this morning, and it seems like we've gone from Ferguson, where there was this, he was a demon, he looked like a demon, he looked like Hulk Hogan. We've gone from Hulk Hogan to the Fat Albert defense. This man was too fat in New York. He was, you know, he was out of shape, and that's what, nothing happened to this man before they put his hands on him. He was standing up, breathing, telling them to leave him alone.
Right.
But when they put their arms on him, that's when he died. You know, if you can't get an indictment now, you simply will not get an indictment unless there is an infusion of justice coming from another form of law. I'm talking federal, some type of an independent type of a body that comes in. Because as a previous caller said, it's not as though they're thumbing their nose at us as black men. I am a black man. They are. And I think, this lastly, I think a lot of this has to do with a black man in the White House. That is virtually impossible from my place to prove, but anecdotal evidence in my everyday experience, I've heard vitriol and nasty talk that I haven't heard in my entire life.
Yeah.
That's all I have to say, Tom.
Yeah, well, you said it well, Dan. Thank you very much for the call, and thanks for listening to WCPT. I think you're right on. Shock, on the other hand, in Indianapolis probably thinks otherwise. You're on the air, Shock.
Well, first of all, I don't particularly care to be labeled conservative, progressive, or whatever. I'm agnostic. But I will tell you, in the case of Dylan Taylor, who was shot by a police officer in Salt Lake, the
you're talking 2 years ago?
No, this happened this summer, actually.
I don't think so. I think that was 2 years ago.
It happened okay. The point I was trying to make was, here's a case where body cameras backed up what the officer did, and why I was bringing it up was not necessarily because I'm, in your words, a conservative, or that I listen to right-wing talkers. I don't. I listen to you just as well as I listen to them. But I just want to see if it's wrong for a white cop, it's wrong for a black cop, but yet the white population in Salt Lake didn't riot and didn't do all the protesting after no indictment.
That's because the white, Shock, get this. You know, as a white guy, maybe you don't understand this, but the white population of Utah, of Salt Lake City, has not been subjected to hundreds of years, or even just decades, or even just last month, of basically oppression by the police, of being stopped constantly for simply walking down the street.
But, Tom, here's what I think the bigger problem is.
No, that's the bigger problem.
I'm going to tell you what I think the real problem is, if you'll give me a moment to explain, and that is that the police force, by and large, are becoming less tolerant to the population as a whole. And therein lies the problem. They're running scared because kids reach of any color reach into their waistbands and do whatever they're doing, and they don't know if they're armed or not. So what their first reaction is protect themselves. They are less tolerant of the population as a whole.
Yeah.
They don't. It's not a color thing. It's a population.
Being a police officer is not even in the top 10 most dangerous professions in the United States.
Okay.
You know, being a meat packer has you have a higher probability of being killed on the job than being a cop. This, you know, you can't excuse this kind of behavior by police by saying, oh, they're afraid of black people. You can't do it. It doesn't happen. I mean, in the United States, we're getting somewhere between a 500 and 1,000 police shootings a year. On the other hand, nationwide in the United States last year, 27 police officers died in the line of duty, more than half of them in car accidents. That had nothing to do with, you know, anybody being adversarial. That's the major risk of life for a cop. As I said, they're not even in the top 10 most dangerous professions in the United States. And yet you're suggesting that we should just, you know, give them all kinds of deference and all, you know, I'm over it.
Where did I say I was suggesting there should be deference? I didn't say that, Tom. Quit putting words in my mouth that don't exist.
All right, I thought it was fairly clearly implied in your comments that, you know, we've got to. Why would you point out that police officers, quote, put their lives on the line if you weren't saying, therefore, we should give them deference?
I didn't say that. What I was saying is, here's their thought process. That's all I said. I didn't say whether it was right or wrong. But see, that's the problem with.
But somebody's thought process is. You know, then let's get people who can think clearly. You know, Darren Wilson was saying, I felt like a 5-year-old. I felt like a child hanging on to Hulk Hogan. That's not the way that an adult male who is fully emotionally developed talks. That's the way somebody who has what's called body dysmorphia, they their perception of who they are and who they really are physically are different. And that's somebody who should not be on a police force. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com, America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com, Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. and EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.
This is the Tom Hartmann Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you, and I'm pleased to have in our studio with us Joe Madison. JoeMadison.net. He's the host of the Joe Madison Show on Sirius XM, channel 126, weekdays 6 to 10 a.m.
Yeah,
I have it right this time.
Yeah.
Joe Madison.
Next week it'll change, I guess.
Well, hopefully not. Joe, this is a rough time in America, and this non-indictment for the cop who killed Eric Garner, and I would say the cops, you know, if you're involved in a crime, you know, if you and I went out and one of us was driving the car and the other one ran in and robbed a bank or something and killed somebody, we could both be prosecuted. Even if one of us never got out of the car, we could both be prosecuted for that murder.
Yeah, you know, the only problem is if I weren't driving and you were, they'd probably ask for my driver's license instead of yours.
Yeah, well, you know.
And that's the old Paul Mooney joke. He talks about being in Hollywood in a car full of white guys who were his friends, and the policeman came up to the car and asked him for his driver's license, and he wasn't even driving.
Oh, geez.
You know, so, and he says it's a true story.
Yeah,
you know?
I believe it.
Yeah,
and
I do too.
You know, it's we've talked about this before. I mean, the only time my son, one of my kids, the only time he ever had an interaction with the police was when he was walking with a black friend. In
well, you know, we had a study, and it's very interesting. 31.7 per million young African Americans between the ages of 15 and 18 are killed by white police officers, compared to 1.4 per million young white boys the same age from 15 to 18.
Killed by police officers of any race?
Killed by police officers, white police officers. Now, the interesting thing about it is these are FBI analysis done on data given to them from law enforcement agencies from different municipalities. But the interesting thing is that a lot of municipalities, including New York City, don't report. They don't report. So the figures may very well even be higher.
Well, and on top of that, back in the 80s during the Reagan administration, there were two pieces of legislation passed, one that forbade the Centers for Disease Control from using federal money to compile handgun death statistics, which include police shootings, and another that forbade the Department of Health and Human Services, HHS, from compiling those kind of statistics. So our federal government has been blocked by law. This was an NRA request to the Republican Party. Has been blocked by law from compiling really good comprehensive statistics. So we don't know. I mean, we know nationwide 27 cops died in the line of duty last year, more than half of them in car accidents. It's not even in the top 10 most dangerous professions. We don't know how many people died. And, you know, it seems like it's somewhere between 500, in the neighborhood of 500 people a year are shot by police, shot dead by police.
See, and this is why I think that this task force that President Obama has put together, they really have got to get into the meat of what you just discussed. It's got to be more than the surface things we discuss on radio, like body cameras. The body camera, I was just reading an article before coming over here, took a hit because we saw what? A camera.
Yeah.
We had a video camera of Gardner's death and his takedown, and now we're debating whether or not it was or was not a chokehold.
Right.
And so, but the point you're just raising, so you've got to look at the Department of Health and Human Services. You've got to look at not just the Justice Department. You've got to look at various departments, and it has to be comprehensive across the board.
Right.
And we can't fall for this. Let's just look at body cameras.
Right.
That's surface talk.
Yeah, no, there's a systemic problem. There's a deep systemic problem.
As your guest in the first hour pointed out, yeah. And, you know, he knows. I mean, I think he's a former prosecutor.
Mike Papantonio. No, he might have been. I'm not sure, but he's a lawyer. He's definitely a high-powered lawyer.
He knows the system, and you could tell it. Yeah. And I feel somewhat naive because I've actually thought the Gardner case that there would be an indictment only because with all that what all New York has gone through, the Abner Louima case. This was the case where the young, I believe, Haitian was sodomized with a broom handle. Now, this is interesting. That officer did get indictment. He did go to trial, but he was acquitted in court. But the Justice Department followed through with a case in violation of Louima's civil rights, and to this day, that officer is in prison.
Right.
So, but I got to tell you, I think the person who really caught my attention yesterday of all the people who were talking, particularly elected officials, it was Charles Rangel. Because Charles Rangel raised an interesting question. He wonders whether or not the prosecutor even asked for an indictment.
Yeah, they did. That did not happen in the case in Ferguson. We know that for a fact.
That's right. So he's wondering, did the Staten Island prosecutor, he wants to know, did he even ask, or did he present this preponderance of information and say, okay, guys, throw up his hands, you guys decide. Right. And that's not how a grand jury is supposed to work.
Right. Right. I'll bet he didn't. And that's why I'm saying that we need to take this completely out of the grand jury. We need to take it completely out of the prosecutor's office. There needs to be, whenever there's a police killing, and frankly, I think that we need to lower that bar. I think, you know, the police robbing people, beating people, raping people, whenever a police officer is charged with a crime, there needs to be a special prosecutor.
That's right.
From the state office.
That's right.
Who is from out of town.
Out of state, but you can't do that.
You can't do that, right?
Right.
And who is presenting before a grand jury, which has been pulled together specifically for this and will be dissolved after this.
That's right. Special grand jury with a special prosecutor. And when I look at Cuomo, he was asked to do it. He didn't.
Right.
And he didn't do it for political reasons.
Right. And same with Jay Nixon.
You just took the words out of my mouth.
Pardon me.
And I don't give a hoot whether they're Democrats or Republicans. But here are two Democrats who could have said, you know what, I'm going to be above board and do exactly what you just described, Tom. And then there wouldn't have been a lot of transparency because you still have that issue because it still would be secretive. But I think people would feel a little bit more comfortable because, as your guest said in the last hour, and I was listening very intently, there is this relationship. If I were a prosecutor and I had to prosecute you, I would have a very difficult time.
Because we know each other.
We know each other. We're friends. Our families know each other. We have a relationship. Hell, you would never invite me back to be on your show.
That's actually a serious point.
But
you don't want to mess with your friends.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
I depend on you. To put criminals away, I depend, and it's not just the prosecutor and police, but it's the prosecutor, police, and as was stated in the last hour, judges.
Yeah, and the grand jury.
They all have a relationship. They depend on each other. And so you're right. It has to be independent. It really does.
Yeah, and at the very least, that would provide the appearance, but it would provide a structure of independence.
And we're only talking about one aspect. Then there's this culture inside the police department. I read a great article the other day, said this isn't so much white officers black, although the element is there, no ifs, ands, buts about it. But this is blue versus black, white, brown, yellow.
Right.
I'll give you these officers who end up going from town to town. You read that article about the officer that killed the 12-year-old?
Yeah, how he had been fired before. Yeah.
Fired? He had a meltdown on a shooting range to the point that they said he's not fit to be a police officer.
Oh.
Wait a minute. In Independence, Ohio, then he decides to go to Cleveland.
Amazing. We'll be right back with Joe Madison.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Check out Joe's website at joemadison.net. And, of course, you can hear him on SiriusXM Channel 126 weekdays, 6 to 10 a.m. We'll be back. Old school. Welcome back. Joe Madison's still with us. And Joe, let's take a couple of phone calls here. And then after that, after the next break, which will be in 4 minutes, I want to get back to you went to Atlanta with Eric Holder.
Yes.
And I'd also like to talk about the role that white America plays in this, because I've been going off for a long time, I think probably most of my audience is white, about white privilege, having these debates with people. And I think that we're not going to see change unless 70% of the population in America starts demanding.
I would just say to my white brothers and sisters, use your privilege.
Yeah, there you go.
Use it, like the lady did in Foxhall, Washington, D.C. neighborhood when she walked out of her. Here was a woman who was a very successful attorney, lived in an exclusive neighborhood, Foxhall in Washington, D.C. There was an alleged break-in around the block. It turned out to be that the owner of the house put in the wrong code. That's why the alarm went off. And then the police showed up, black police officers, by the way, and jumped a 67-year-old man who had suffered a stroke, who had been working in the neighborhood doing odd jobs for 30 years. That woman marched out of her house, told them to get the hell away from this man. I'm a lawyer. I want your card. And you will not profile him. Right. That's what needs to be done by everybody.
Yeah.
And this stuff will stop.
Yeah. Yeah. Enough of us need to stand up. And it's just all of us. Absolutely all of us. Okay. Alan, watching Free Speech TV in Joshua, Texas. Alan, you're on the air with Joe and me.
Hey, Tom. Hey, thanks. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to point out that basically what these cops are doing is claiming cowardice when it's convenient for them. You know, and here we are in the home of the brave of America.
How so?
They're saying
Darren Wilson saying that he was fearing for his life, therefore he was justified.
Right. You know, I mean, they're just, it's, you know, these people who are predisposed to fear don't need to be our police.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you, Alan. Thank you for this really raises the larger question, Joe, and this is one of my other calls to action. If you look at, like in the UK, there were two police killings all of last year.
Yes, I read that.
Here there was like a 500 to 1,000. In most of the European countries, I don't know the UK, but I know in Northern Europe and in Germany, being a police officer is not just like a profession like being, you know, a guy who fixes cars or something like it is in the United States. So the pay is, you know, kind of middle class. It's upper middle class. It's like, you know, this is a profession. It's something people go into for a life, and it's very hard to get to be a cop. There's a lot of competition.
I had an officer call me. Matter of fact, he described himself, so that's what I'm bringing up. He said, "Look, I'm from Tupelo, Mississippi. I'm a white officer." And he basically said what your caller just said. He says, however, in Tupelo, they have to have at least an associate degree in criminal law at minimum. Now, it's funny. That's Tupelo. And he says we go through background checks, psychological background checks. We go through tremendous amount of training that we have to have. Now, I don't know what they get paid, but I agree with you. And then when I looked at the Cleveland requirements, you can have, and don't get me wrong, you can have a GED and become a police officer in Cleveland.
Yeah. Well, as a guy with a GED.
I mean, that's what I'm saying. You understand.
Yeah, no, I absolutely, understand.
We're talk show hosts. We don't have this. I'm sure.
There you go. We'll be back with Joe Madison right over there. 20 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Joe Madison in the studio with us. JoeMadison.net. His website is show on SiriusXM channel 126, weekdays 6 to 10 a.m. And, Joe, two quick things I wanted to talk to you about. One is you were just down in Atlanta with Eric Holder. Tell us about that.
Well, we were asked, along with Zeke Miller of Time Magazine, who covers the White House, the two of us were asked to if we would like to accompany the Attorney General to Atlanta, where he met with students, community leaders, police officials, Justice Department officials, mayors, or other elected officials, And at Ebenezer Baptist Church, this is the historic church of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., it was packed to the rafters and with lines out the door with people trying to get in. And they had organized, even before Gardner, even before Ferguson's decision, a community speak out.
Wow.
And it was amazing because these are young people, older civil rights leaders that had walked and marched with Dr. King were there, all kinds of people. And basically, they were there to say enough's enough and make certain demands on the attorney general. And many of the demands were included in his speech. One, the body cams, the training. Let me stick there for a moment. The president has asked for $200+ million for body cams and training. Because
right.
He recognizes this can't be just body cameras. You got to have new different kind of training. That should be a nonpartisan issue. I mean, that should be approved by Congress. And then I must tell you, I talked with Emmanuel Cleaver, and he said the concern he has is that they want a federal law passed to require the police departments, the police agencies, to take the money and do it. He says one thing, you can offer it,
right,
but you may get a lot of pushback from agencies that they're not going to do it. You right. can't make them do it. The other thing was, and I think the attorney general is going to announce maybe next week, how to end racial profiling.
How do you do that?
Yeah, I don't know. And he's putting together, he's asked his staff and I guess experts in the field that they're going to put together guidelines where they will now go into different cities and train people on how to end racial profiling. Now, that will be interesting to see what those guidelines are.
Yeah.
And then there was this, you know, CNN, who had a headline that said he was heckled because a group of students stood up in the middle of his speech and they, in essence, spoke out. He stopped and he let them for about 5, 10, you know, I don't know, maybe 6 minutes. And then they threw their hands up, and they marched out. Well, the audience of a couple of thousand gave him a standing ovation.
Yeah.
And then the attorney general said, look, that's democracy. That's what these young people are supposed to do.
Yeah.
And then he said, it's very interesting, he said, I ain't mad at them. And then the audience gave him a standing ovation.
That's just like when President Obama was interrupted by Madea Benjamin, and he said after she got dragged out of the room, he said, we need to listen to that woman.
And if I hadn't gone with the attorney general and only watched that snapshot on television, I would have thought that they were heckling him or, you know, a protest demonstrating against him. They weren't.
They were honest.
What young people are saying is the same thing we said during the Vietnam War when we were young. Enough's enough. We're not going to put up with this. I heard your show the other day, you know, talking about our demonstrations and our protests. Marion Barry, we're funeralizing him this Saturday. Marion Barry and SNCC, John Lewis, Eleanor Holmes Norton. My God, look, these are people now in the winter of their lives. But how did they start? They were from Yale. They were from Harvard. They were from Fisk. They were from Tennessee. They were from Morehouse. And what did they do? They said, our generation is not going to put up with this. Jim Crow's going to end. We're going to stop it. We're not going to put up with segregation laws. And they sacrificed, many of them, their education, obviously their lives. Our young people, our children are doing the same thing we did, and we need to support them.
Yeah.
And as the attorney general said, it has to be peaceful. You can't go around burning and destroying, because that's not going to get you anything. Matter of fact, it's going to get you trapped.
Right.
I had somebody called in on my show this morning and said, when is black America going to radicalize? this is radical. Mm-hmm. I mean, remember, Martin Luther King was considered a radical.
Yeah.
A radical.
Yeah. We just have a minute until the break, but I want white America to get radicalized too. I mean, we got 70% of the population here that's sitting around, and the vast majority of them don't even know what white privilege means.
And all I'm saying is that woman in Foxhall, she was obviously privileged. She is well-to-do. She did not have to come out of her house. She did not have to defend that man. She did. And when I look at least the snapshots I'm seeing, and when I went to Ferguson, you know, I've seen a lot of white Americans. I've seen Hispanics. I've seen former police officers. I don't know about you, but I'm getting a lot of calls from police officers and former police officers who are saying this is crazy. This has got to stop.
Yeah, yeah. We're in kind of a national insanity spiral, and you know, thank God it's all coming to the fore, because frankly, this isn't new. I mean, this stuff has been going on every day, every year,
as long
as you and I have been alive, and a long time before.
Most of the riots of the 60s got started because of...
Every single time, because somebody got shot by a cop.
Thank you.
Every single
time. And that's what I told the young people. This is not new.
Yeah, there you go. Joe Madison with us. The Black Eagles show, the Joe Madison Show on Sirius XM Channel 126, JoeMadison.net. We'll be back with your calls and Joe's thoughts and my thoughts.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
And all that kind of thing. Be sure to check out Joe's website, JoeMadison.net. We'll be right back. Welcome back. 28 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, and Joe Madison in the studio with us. JoeMadison.com will get you to his website.
Well, yeah, or, .com, .net. Either one will work.
There you go. Okay, let's pick up some phone calls here, Joe. Let's see what people have to say. Walter in Leesburg, Virginia. You're on the air.
Hey, thanks, Tom. I just want but thanks, Joe, too. I just can't believe that they did not vet that guy from Cleveland, the officer. I think his name is Lohman or something.
Lohman, yeah.
Yeah, I can't believe it. I'm like, unbelievable. If they didn't vet that
2 seconds.
Guy.
Well, yeah. Oh, yeah. He was. But his story is amazing, Tom. And the caller,
you
know the story, don't you, Walt?
But Walter's gone.
Oh, well. This is what happened. They put it in writing. The Independence, Ohio, his sergeant said he is unfit to be a police officer. He's unfit. And apparently what happened, he was distraught over a girlfriend breaking up or something. He happens to be at the gun range for training. He's weepy. That's what this is in the memo. He's weepy. He's depressed. He was a poor marksman. The sergeant said he had no business being alive or being around live guns.
Whoa.
And the sergeant said he tried to, you know, help him out, even took a break, took him to lunch, said he was a mental case. And then the sergeant wrote a memo, put it in the personnel file and said, look, this guy is unfit to be in the employment of the city of Independence, which meant a policeman. So he apparently quits. And then the next thing you know, a few months later, I believe it was, sometime later, he gets hired in Cleveland. Now, the people in Cleveland are trying to cover their behinds and saying, well, we don't know if we saw that memo. We don't know if we did this and did that. Now, that's when the police officer from Tupelo called me and said, wait a minute. We go through through extensive background checks, psychological checks. I had to go through two, he said. I can't imagine in Cleveland, Ohio, a major city like that, that, you know, that somebody from Independence. And there's the problem you have is that these guys will, and I've seen this over and over, they'll high profile cases. So they end up quitting.
Right.
And then they go to, they move down the road. And they become an officer in some other town or some other state. I don't know. I think they ought to treat them like they do doctors that get malpractice cases and lose their license. I don't think they should ever be a police officer again, should never have a badge and a gun again.
Yeah, it's so in other words, there would be some sort of a certification board like the AMA
and a list.
There you go.
And a list.
There you go. Richard, driving through Utah, you are on the air with Joe Madison and me.
Hey, hi, Tom. Joe, how are you guys doing today?
I'm fine. How are you, sir?
Good.
Doing great. I had two quick points for you. First of all, I'm going to lead with what my second point is. To the officer in Cleveland situation, apparently we've got about 20 states in this country that have adopted what's called an officer's bill of rights, which basically says that officers' past histories are kept secret and cannot be used against them in future hiring.
Wow.
So an officer can go from one place to another depending on where he did wrong, and his past history is a closed book like a person's juvenile file would be.
Wow.
And it cannot be brought up.
We'll have to look into that. Yeah, that sounds
I wish you, if you have it or know where we can get it, and I hate to say that because I always tell my callers to do their own homework, but I'll look it up. And it's referred to as an officer's bill of rights.
It's an officer's bill of rights, and it's mostly been stuff that have been brought up by the Fraternal Brotherhood of Police Officers.
Sure, sure.
Right. And every so often, apparently, they go to the U.S. government and try to push this same thing through our Congress at a federal level to make it a nationwide blanket.
Oh, okay.
Wow.
Well, I can definitely look. I'll look for that.
And then Richard, say what? Oh, okay. Shano tracked it down. He's printing it out, so we'll tell you all about it later. Richard, you wanted to mention a Wisconsin amendment of the state constitution?
Yes. Within the last year or two, Scott Walker signed a bill into law that was pushed through by the father of a young kid who was shot and executed by I believe it was Kenosha, Wisconsin police officer. It was about 10 years ago. An officer got into a scuffle with a young white kid, drew his service revolver or his service pistol, put it to the kid's head, pulled the trigger, the weapon misfired. He chambered a fresh round, put it right back to the kid's temple, and blew his head off. Whoa. In front of the kid's mother and sister. The father was a retired lieutenant colonel in the Air Force who said, okay, we're going to let the system take care of this officer. And when the officer, the police department, and the DA basically cleared him of any wrongdoing, even with the testimony of the witnesses, the father went on a 10-year crusade and was able to push through the state legislature a law that says that any police shooting that results in someone's death cannot be handled and investigated by the local authorities. It has to be investigated by an independent state commission.
Wow.
It's taken out of the hands of the local police department and the local DA. They have nothing to do with it.
So Wisconsin just solved the problem, and they did so because a white kid got shot.
Exactly.
Well,
the problem is solved.
At least the problem is solved. That's why I said this is not black versus white as much as it is in the larger scope, blue versus white, brown, black, yellow. There's another case, and we have it on our Facebook. Knox, and this is interesting. A student, white student, Knoxville, Tennessee. We have the photograph that you can look that one up too, and where the police officer is choking this. I'm not kidding you, choking this student who was protesting to the point he dropped to his knees. And now, but get this. The chief of police, the sheriff, I should say, of Knoxville, fired him immediately. Fired him immediately.
He was choking
a white kid. He was choking a white kid. And there's the photograph. You go to the website, Joe Madison Black Eagle. I guess, what is it? Hashtag whatever. Facebook, Joe Madison Black Eagle. Yeah. And there's the photograph and the guy, and they caught it on camera. But the thing was interesting is that the sheriff fired him immediately. This is why I say these are the kinds of things that have to happen, because, as you said, it's systemic. And it's and there's so many balls in the air that people are having to juggle. So it's we've got to, the narrative, Tom, has to be beyond one or two things. You know, there's some constitutional questions here. There's legal questions here. There's a, I mean, I'm one of these people who believe, I don't know about you, that you should have citizen review boards. Remember when they first started?
Yep.
But then they created citizens review boards, and they couldn't even subpoena somebody to come and testify. So you would have policemen or chiefs of police who say, no, you're not going. Because, and they didn't have the power to make them come and testify. Right. That has to change.
Right. Give them the power of subpoena.
That's right.
Yeah. It's an amazing time in America, I really think.
I think what's amazing is that, you know, is this visceral reaction that where people of all nationalities are saying, you know what, that's it.
Yeah.
And that's it. Enough's enough. And you just simply cannot fool people. I mean, this last one, it's like, don't believe your lying eyes.
Right.
I'm watching you choke this man. I'm listening to this man. And then to hear Congressman King, did you hear what he said?
Yeah. Yeah. If he hadn't been overweight or.
No, well, and how can you, if you can't breathe, how can you talk?
Yeah. This is blame the victim. I mean, it's just good old fashioned blame the victim. And Peter King is one of the more bizarre members of the. Of the House of Representatives.
There must be a caucus up there.
it's called the Tea Party Caucus.
The bizarre caucus.
I don't know. It's an amazing time. We have just a little less than a minute left before the break, Joe. What I'm looking at is white conservatives saying, wait a minute, don't change things because conservatives just don't like change, and we have to have change. And white liberals saying, well, life isn't all that bad, you know, because they're not in the middle of it. I think a lot of white liberals don't even know anybody.
Like I said, you're absolutely right about that. And it's good of you to say that because your relationships are a lot different. And race is an issue when a police officer, let's take Mark Furman. For example, who just happened to pop up on one
Fox
of the Fox shows somewhere. Where else is he going to pop up? But here was a guy who had a problem because he didn't like to see black guys driving around with white women as their dates in Los Angeles. And he said he never used the N-word. They had him using it a million times on tape. You know, they don't look at me and say, are you a conservative? Are you a Baptist? Are you liberal?
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We'll be right back with Joe Madison. Stick around. She's well. Welcome back. Joe Madison still in the studio with us. You were telling a story. You want to finish that?
Underscoring your point, you know, they're not. Let's be straight up. If black police officers were shooting young white 18 to 24 young white men and women the same rate that young black men and women get shot, this issue would have been resolved long ago.
Yeah,
that's how this country operates. There is a great book. People always refer to it. I wish they take the time to read it or at least download it on audiobooks. And that's Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow. This goes back to, you know, 400 or 500 years. It goes to the Fugitive Act. What was the Fugitive Act? You could be a free black man and the police could pick you up. And just snatch you off the street. Even after, let's go to the modern times. Doug Blackman, great book, where you could be arrested if you didn't have a job.
Right.
in the South.
And they, well, the, that's still going on. Now it's if you're homeless, you can be arrested.
That's right.
And if you help somebody who's homeless, or you feed somebody who's homeless,
you can be arrested. I mean, this is, we keep saying it's systemic, but it's being exposed. And I think a great deal shows like yours, mine, social media, you know, people are going after this. It's a question of whether or not the elected officials have the, well, I was going to say have the will to change. But you know what? I'm tired of waiting on them to have the will to change. We have to change them.
Yeah.
You know, so I'm doing a show tomorrow where I interviewed at Newseum. I had a town round table discussion with a professor of journalism from Maryland, University of Maryland, and GW. One of the professor happened to also be a lawyer as well as a professor of journalism. But he made a very interesting observation, and I wanted to bring this to you, about the First and Second Amendment and voting. And he said the founders understood voting was really is a First Amendment activity. Because you're petitioning your government. The purpose of the First Amendment was to make sure citizens could challenge their government. Because in Europe, as you know, if you challenge the Pope, you chop your head off, or the King, you chop your head off. And voting was again an expression of speech.
Yep.
And then they came back and said, "Look, if the government doesn't listen to you, we've got the Second Amendment." I never thought of that. And then you know what he related it to? Malcolm X's speech, the ballot or the bullet.
Right.
And he said, that's what government has to understand. You better start listening to people.
Yeah.
You better start listening to them. And when they and people can speak with the vote. If not, there's the Second Amendment. I want to vote.
That can get kind of edgy. Joe Madison.
That's why I gave it to you.
Yeah.
You can work on it.
Joe, it's great having
you.
Thanks so much. Joe Madison, joemadison.com. And, of course, check him out, Sirius 126, Sirius XM.
Oh, thank
we'll
you.
Be back. Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you 10 minutes before the hour. Let's check in with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com, where you can help a returning slave in South Sudan, and free-don.org. Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service is on the line with us. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
So what's going on in the world today?
A great deal. National civil rights leaders today are releasing a longer-term 2015 action plan to address excessive force by law enforcement and police accountability one day after the grand jury in Staten Island cleared New York police officer Daniel Pantaleo in the death of Eric Garner during an arrest attempt in July. And as you know, Staten Island is the most conservative of the five boroughs in New York City, and a lot of police officers and firefighters live there. Which is interesting.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to know the relationships of the people on that grand jury.
Yeah.
Particularly the 15 white people on that grand jury.
It would be. A white former police chief in Utahville, South Carolina, has been indicted on a murder charge in the 2011 shooting death of an unarmed black man in the town hall parking lot, a county clerk's office said today.
Wow.
Yes. Combs fatally shot Utahville resident Bernard Bailey after they scuffled. Bailey arrived for to argue at the town hall about his daughter's traffic ticket. And when he arrived, Combs told him there was a warrant out for his arrest for obstruction of justice. They had an exchange, and Bailey then tried to drive away, and that's when Combs fired the shot. Now, Combs said that he tangled in Bailey's steering wheel and feared for his life if Bailey drove away. But a prosecutor said that Combs, who was fired 6 months after the shooting, was the aggressor. No charges were initially filed. The FBI and state law enforcement investigated. And anyway, now he was initially charged with misconduct in office, which could bring 10 years in prison. And then now he has been got a murder charge against
him. In what venue?
In what venue?
Yeah. Is he being charged by the local authorities? Is he being charged by the state authorities? Or is he being charged in federal court?
My understanding is that from the Reuters story that I've got, it looks like it's a local.
Very interesting.
Looks like it's local, but this is a very new story, so it's not clear to me.
Okay. All right.
Also, a Justice Department investigation has found that Cleveland police officers, who, as you know, are in the spotlight after the shooting of Tamir Rice, a 12-year-old boy who had a fake gun in a playground. Cleveland police officers use guns, tasers, pepper spray, and their fists either unnecessarily or in retaliation while using excessive force on those who are mentally ill or in crisis, according to this Justice Department investigation. As a result of this, quote, pattern of unreasonable and unnecessary use of force, unquote, the city and the Justice Department have signed an agreement to develop a court-enforceable consent decree that will include a requirement for an independent monitor who will oversee and ensure necessary reforms.
Hmm.
So that is out today also.
You know why Northern Europe, particularly I know this about Norway, the reason why Norway has such high standards for police, high pay for police, so few citizen interactions with police, and very rational jailing. I mean, it's very rare that somebody goes to jail, and if they do, they always there's not even a life sentence in Norway. The reason why is because they were occupied by the Nazis during World War II, and the citizens of Germany or of Norway were just so horrified by basically a police state that they said, you know, we're never going to have a police state here in Norway. We're going to keep the police on a short leash. And I just wonder if, America, and largely white America right now, is starting to wake up to the fact that the police misbehavior in this country is, I don't want to, draw parallels to the Nazis, but is beyond the pale right now. Anyhow, I'm ruminating. Victoria, back to you for the news. I'm sorry.
No, it's an interesting rumination. Ignoring objections from conservative Republicans, U.S. House Speaker John Boehner today vowed to plow ahead with a spending bill that avoids a government shutdown while also hoping to keep, in his mind, some budget leverage over President Obama's immigration order. Part of Boehner's strategy to appease hardline conservatives, because there is a strategy, is to hold a vote today on a bill that retroactively rescinds Obama's executive authority over immigration, effectively declaring his action illegal. But it's going to be symbolic because Democrats who control the Senate have said they won't take it up, and the White House today issued a veto threat. Anyway.
Well, and so, that would be a constitutional crisis. That's the kind of thing that would throw to the Supreme Court,
right,
if it's between the two
right,
branches.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
But Boehner's got to put a fig leaf on this thing.
Exactly. And is it going to appease conservatives? Well, the hell no caucus is basically going to say hell no.
Yeah, of course.
In my view.
Of course.
Boehner also is saying that he thinks that they might need Democratic votes in order to pass the spending bill through the House. And the Democrats, Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi and Steny Hoyer, her number two, are keeping their powder dry, enjoying maybe a small moment in the sun with some power. They are not indicating one way or the other how they will go on this, whether they will, in fact, support Boehner on the spending bill. They probably will.
Yeah. Okay.
Members of the Republican Party are asking the Supreme Court to take up another case against Obamacare, this time challenging the controversial medical board that the party's called a death panel.
Mm-hmm.
That's the Independent Payment Advisory Board.
Right.
Senators Tom Coburn, Representative Phil Rowe, and several other Republicans are filing an amicus brief today urging the court to reconsider a case against the payment board. Now, one case against it has already been dismissed by an appeals court, that's where they argued that the Medical Advisory Board oversteps the bounds of separation of powers. That's already gone down once. They
amazing.
Say it's the law frees the board of checks and balances.
Yeah, I thought the board was a check and balance. But anyhow, Victoria Jones, the Talk Radio News Service. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com, America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com, Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show. So please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, the third hour of our show. Peter DeFazio, Congressman DeFazio, will be with us a little later on in the hour. He was just called away for a vote. Apparently, John Boehner is calling a vote on the floor of the House where they're basically going to eliminate the power of President Obama to pause deportations of people, as he has done with his executive order. It's a symbolic vote. It's not going to go anywhere. It'll pass the House because the Republicans control the House, but when it gets to the Senate, right now the Democrats control the Senate, at least until January. They will, you know, it will die in the Senate. But this is something that Boehner is doing to make the crazy right-wingers feel okay. In the you can't make this stuff up category, this is a post. I think this was over at Daily Kos, but I could be wrong. It was posted by WFBMM. And a fellow by the name of Brandon McKean in Pontiac, Michigan. It was 33 degrees on Thanksgiving Day, and it was snowing. He's walking down the street with his hands in his pocket because it's snowing and it's 33 degrees out, and a police officer pulls him over. Detained and questioned by a police officer. Here's the transcript. Brandon McKean, who is, by the way, videotaping this incident with his camera. He says, all right, well, what? And the cop says, you were walking by. And Brandon says, okay. And then the cop says something to dispatch, which is unintelligible. And Brandon says, walking by and doing what? Cop, well, you were making people nervous. Brandon, by walking by? Cop takes out camera phone. Yeah, they said you had your hands in your pockets. Brandon, wow, walking by with your hands in your pockets makes people nervous to call the police when it's snowing outside? Cop, they did. Brian, okay. Cop, so you okay? Brandon, I'm fine. How about you? Cop, I'm good. Brandon, all right. Cop, what are you up to today? Brandon, walking with my hands in my pockets. Walking. Cop, is it an inconvenience to talk to me right now? Brandon, hell yeah! Just because of the whole police situation going on across the country. This is outrageous that you would let somebody tell you, oh, there's somebody walking down the street with their hands in their pockets. There's 10,000 people at Pontiac right now with their hands in their pockets. So how many? And the cop interrupts and says, you're right, but we do have a lot of robberies. Right. You're a black guy, after all. Amazing. Now, on the flip side of this, this Twitter hashtag, criming while white, hashtag C-R-I-M-I-N-G, while, W-H-I-L-E, white, W-H-I-T-E, it's white people confessing crimes that they got away with. A demonstration of white privilege. And they were, Twitter was registering over 600 a minute last night as this thing was ramping, this hashtag was ramping up. Here's a sample of them. Cecily says, at 13, I stole a car with my friends and drove it 2 weeks before we got busted. The only one charged was black. Amy writes, I've been pulled over for some ridiculous reasons in D.C., and I always argue or mouth off. The worst outcome is just a ticket. Robin writes, I dined and dashed. Cop found me at the movies. I paid the bill and he left. I was rude, but I was not arrested and I was not killed. Crying while white. Joel writes, I shoplifted when I was 14 and they let me go because my parents came down and, quote, we looked like a nice family. Crying while white. Chris writes, I got caught shoplifting at a water park when I was a kid. Instead of calling the police, they called my dad. Crying while white. Nancy writes, many white friends pulled over for DUI in college. Cops followed them home to make sure they got home safe. No arrests. Crying while white. Natural writes, someone very close to me assaulted a state police officer at a traffic stop once. Was out by 9 a.m. and later beat the case. Crying while white. It's very interesting. This is going on. A couple of other things in the news that I want to talk about, and I'll pick up some of your phone calls here. Actually, a bunch of other things. You ever heard of North Pole? The town of North Pole? It's in Alaska. It's up near the North Pole. It's not that close to the North Pole because the Arctic Ocean is an ocean, right? It's water. So the North Pole is underwater. But North Pole, Alaska is, you know, like their street lights are candy cane themed and everything. You know, there's a Santa house. I mean, it's all about Santa, right? Mail to the North Pole goes to North Pole, Alaska. North Pole, Alaska is suing an oil company owned by the Koch brothers for polluting their water. The Koch brothers versus Santa Claus, or some variation thereof. This is the pollution is by a compound called sulfalane. And the lawsuit reads, the presence of sulfalane contamination in the city's groundwater has rendered that groundwater unfit for human consumption and endangers the public health or welfare. Ultimately, these hazardous substances have migrated off the refinery property and have contaminated the groundwater downgradient of the refinery and within the city, including wells owned by the city and supplying drinking water to the city's inhabitants. This is a company called Flint Hills Alaska Resources, which is owned by Koch Industries, was previously owned by Williams Alaska Petroleum. And this has been the largest refinery in the state of Alaska since 1977. It's called the Earth Resources Oil Refinery. It's connected to the Trans-Alaska Pipeline System, one of the largest pipelines in the world. And since 2004, it's been owned by the Koch subsidiary Flint Hills Resources. It's been known that they've been polluting since 2001. But in 2009, they discovered high levels of the chemical in it, and you know, so on it goes. So anyway, I just thought that was interesting. I talked yesterday at some length, in fact, did pretty much the entire show, about the situation with regard to the price of oil and the banks. And there's a bunch of stories. It's just been an incredible, an explosion of stories over at the Financial Times about this stuff. And I'll just share some of this with you very quickly. Here's just first the headlines, right? I mean, this, keep in mind, the Financial Times is rich people talking to rich people, business talking to business. Flow of OPEC petrodollars set to dry up. This is by Anji Raval, the oil and gas correspondent for the Financial Times. He writes, the flow of OPEC petrodollars into a global financial markets is set to dry up as the collapse in the oil price delivers a $316 billion hit to the oil cartel's revenues. And then he goes through all these examples, but this is a 40% fall in Brent crude since mid-June. Here's another one. Extreme oil bears bet on $40 crude. Yeah, there are people who are buying options. They're buying puts on oil that will pay at $40 a barrel. It's amazing. The number of options to sell U.S. crude at $40 a barrel by December of next year was equivalent to 880,000 barrels, more than quadrupling in the past 2 weeks. I've been looking at volume on VXX. VXX is the stock you buy if you want to bet against the stock market. I'm not recommending that. I just think it's fascinating looking at the volume. It's really cheap right now. It's like $20 a share or something like that. It was several thousand dollars a share. I think it was around $5,000 or $6,000 a share in 2008 when the stock market was way down. Market goes down, VXX goes up, and vice versa, which is why it's cheap right now because the stock market's hitting new highs. But if you look at the volume, it's incredible. The last couple of weeks, the volume in VXX has just, it looks to me like it has really, really gone up. And, you know, it's presumably people hedging their bets, as it were. Cheaper oil's knock-on effect on asset prices. James McIntosh, writing at the Financial Times, he notes oil producers don't just sell oil, they invest proceeds into foreign assets. So, you know, asset managers cut oil debt exposure is another one. I point all this out to you because I think that, you know, we've got very real social problems going on in the United States today, which we've been talking about for most of this program. We also have the potential for a very real economic disaster facing us that I wrote about in my book, The Crash of 2016.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I'm increasingly concerned that this radical reduction in the price of oil could be the thing that precipitates the crash of 2016. Time will tell. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, 15 minutes past the hour. Patrick in Norcross, Georgia, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. Hey, Patrick, what's up?
Hey, how you doing today? I wish Joe was still sitting with you. We keep hearing all of these stats that everybody's throwing out like he did, you know, 31.7 black men per million are killed each year, only 1.4 per million of the white people. But it hasn't been mentioned by anybody that 73% of black people that are shot by a black person.
And what percentage of white people who are shot by white people?
Beg your pardon?
What percentage of white people who are shot by white people?
That's very low. It's about 15%.
No, I'm sorry.
It's
like 90%, Patrick. No.
84%.
Patrick, don't even try it. You know, don't even try it. I'm not going to go there. It's this is the most pathetic argument when you're confronted with the reality that police, that white cops are killing black kids, and then you come along and you say, well, black people kill each other. Well, yeah, duh. Why is there poverty in black neighborhoods? Because of people with attitudes like you, Patrick. Frankly, and it's time for you to wake up and take some of this stuff seriously. What's going on? Keith in Landrum, South Carolina. Hey, Keith, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom. 2 points. The first, watched Chris Matthews talk to Rand Paul last night, and I couldn't believe how much they were buddy-buddies. You were talking about an analogy with Pap in Hour 1, right. And mine is the sexual harassment in the military and how that is handled in the chain of command when there should be an independent review.
You're right, and Kirsten Gillibrand tried to get independent review for it. The Republicans shot it down.
Yeah. My next point is a counterpoint to body cams. What I see is a problem with that is if police are talking to witnesses that want to talk off the record, or they're talking to snitches or protected people such as that, they would no longer want to talk if they knew that they were being recorded, and the NSA would love to get that recording.
Yeah, I'm very ambivalent about body cameras. I think that it might be useful. It's the devil's in the details. I keep saying, if you're going to put body cameras on cops, then you need to change the rules of evidence so that if a police officer is charged with a crime and that crime was not recorded by his body camera and the lack of recording had to do with some volitional act on the part of the police officer, in other words, he didn't turn the camera on or he did turn the camera off, then he has to prove his innocence rather than the state has to prove his guilt in that case.
Yeah, but how would somebody that wants to talk off the record know if the camera is on or off? And it's easy to forget to turn off your own cell phone. So
yeah. Well, and then there's this larger issue of, do we want to live in RoboCop world where you know, the police, and this is the, you know, here I am, a liberal who, you know, embraces the idea of government being, you know, good for us and administering the public good. But I also acknowledge that when government has too much power, particularly policing power, it can be a very bad thing. And do we want every cop in America to be videotaping every single interaction with every human being in this country and have it all end up in a database, you know, in Utah where the NSA is or something like that. I'm a little skitsy about that. Keith, thanks a lot for the call. A little sketchy about it. Whatever. I don't know what the word is, but I'm ambivalent about it. That's exactly what I'm saying. 20 minutes past. Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you. 20 minutes past the hour. And Donna in Columbia, California. Hey, Donna, welcome to the program. Thanks for calling.
Thank you, Tom. I just wanted to make a couple short points. I used to work for state parks for about 20 years, where the rangers are now morphed into state park police, which has created kind of a mission schizophrenia. It was my observation over a 20-year period when this change was ushered in, unwarranted fear also was ushered in among the police officers, and which was unwarranted because most of the contacts were very minor nature.
Yeah, my recollection of state park guys and gals, you know, men and women, was that they didn't even wear weapons. They were unarmed, were they not?
Oh, well, they're armed to the teeth now. They have sidearms, rifles, billy clubs, the vests, everything. They are cops now. We call their training centers cop shops. But I think when that much fear is apparently imbued in law enforcement, a lot of the decisions are created from the hindbrain, which always takes everything up to the most extreme level. For instance, a couple had their little puppy on the beach, and a ranger cop went down and told them they had to have it on a leash. As puppies often do, that he started playing tug-of-war with the ranger's tip of his boot. The ranger took out his gun and shot the puppy.
Oh, jeez.
So over many instances, that's just one instance where I saw a complete lack of respect for the public, mainly based from fear, also endemic racism that permeates so much of our culture and is so embarrassing. I'm reading Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz's book, An Indigenous People's History of the United States.
Right.
Beautifully ties this all in. I finished it night before last, and I'm still kind of digesting a lot of the information. All of it's kind of tied together with that book. I highly recommend it.
I'll check it out. Donna, thank you for the call, and thanks for the information. Stephen in McAllen, Texas. Hey, Stephen. Stephen is not there, apparently. Kurt in Los Angeles. Hey, Kurt.
Hey, good morning, Tom. Afternoon, I'm sorry. I was hoping to get on before Mr. Madison left, but hopefully you can indulge in my thoughts here.
Sure.
Do you remember Operation Clean Sweep back in 1987, conducted by the FBI, what that was all about?
That was they were going against white supremacists, weren't they?
Well, yeah. I mean, but it was a pretty big deal. It was the rounding up of an entire group called the Order,
right,
and they arrested over 22, close to 30 individuals that were responsible for the assassination of radio host Alan Berg,
right,
and also the heist of $3.6 million in Northern California of an armored truck or a bank or something. I'm not sure where they stole it from. I just know they stole millions of dollars.
Yeah, and these guys were real into the what's the book that the Turner Diaries.
Yes.
Yeah. The end of America stuff, white supremacist stuff. Yeah, I remember.
Right, right. And so the reason why their little reign only lasted so long, though, is because they took a violent approach, and that only lasts so long. Also, too, they were implicated in an assassination conspiracy to assassinate a judge.
Right.
Also, and that's what really dropped the hammer. I mean, when you start, you know, trying to kill other whites, prominent whites, that's when you cross the line. So they got bopped. They got busted, okay?
Yeah.
And sentenced to 150 years in jail, hope but 9 yards. The reason I bring that up is because we have not had Every 10 years or so, there's always some type of resurgence of white supremacists. I mean, you had McVeigh blowing up the Murr building. You had the Ruby Ridge. We had some guy didn't want to pay taxes. So, you know, then it happened. Then you had Waco. You know, every couple of 10 years or so, you get these resurgence.
Right.
But you never really get rid of the cancer.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a story at the very top of the Think Progress blog today. In fact, I was going to go off on it today, and I just, you know, haven't gotten around to it yet. I'll probably do it tomorrow at some length, and I'm trying to find it here. Yeah, it's titled The Christian Terrorist Movement No One Wants to Talk About. And they're talking about last Friday, Larry McWilliams was shot and killed by police after he fired more than 100 rounds into downtown Austin, Texas. And turns out he was part of this church, the Vigilantes of Christendom, is the book that this thing is based on. By again, in the Phineas Priesthood, it's a white supremacist movement that opposes racial, interracial anything, sex, marriage, whatever, racial integration, opposes homosexuality, opposes abortion. And they've been convicted of bank robberies, bombing abortion clinics, planning to blow up government buildings. And we've got a terrorism problem here in the United States, Christian terrorists.
Right, right.
White Christian terrorists.
Right. And so before I lose my time here, what I wanted to bring up is that I know for a fact that at some point in time, some of the leaders within the Ku Klux Klan and some of these supremacist groups, they figured out instead of trying to beat them, let's join them. Okay. And I know this because I've done some research, and I know for a fact that a former Grand Dragon has been pushing an agenda to actually help neo-Nazi members to grow the hair out and become policemen. And if they're interested in the law, actually put up the money to send them to law school and become judges. So instead of assassinating judges, they're pushing an agenda in order to put their people in positions of law-abiding power structure so that when something does go down, they're in a better position to thwart.
That's interesting. I'm unaware of that, Kurt. I am aware of the fact that they aggressively recruit in prisons and they aggressively recruit in the military. But that makes sense. Kurt, thanks a lot for the call. I'm going to have to do some homework on that. 28 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
We'll be back with more of your calls. Maybe Peter DeFazio will drop by. It depends on how long John Boehner decides to hold his vote open. We'll be back. Welcome back. 28 minutes before the hour, the screaming headline across the top of Drudge. New Dawn, China, world's biggest economy. For the first time since Ulysses S. Grant was president, the United States is not the leading economic power on the planet. Probably all true. What I'm guessing Drudge is not pointing out in the links that he's directing people to off his website is that this is the consequence of a policy that was promoted by Ronald Reagan. Free trade, in quotes. Now, it was also promoted by Bill Clinton. I mean, you know, we have to acknowledge that. But there are not, to the best of my knowledge, any Republicans in the House of Representatives or the Senate who are saying, let's end free trade. In fact, the Republicans are just gleeful about the possibility of surrendering their authority under the Constitution to modify trade agreements, treaties between countries. They have to be ratified by two-thirds of the Senate. Instead, they want to give that up and say straight up or down vote, no amendments, majority rules. It's called fast track. They want to do fast track. And fast track is just insanely destructive. So if you're unhappy about the fact that, you know, all of our jobs have gone to China, or, you know, not all of them, but certainly tens of millions of them have gone to China, then look no farther than Mr. Reagan. B in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Hey, B, thanks for listening to KTNF. What's up?
Sure. I just wanted to, first of all, just to kind of posit who I am in your head. I mean, I'm like a Shirley Chisholm button owner, you know, in terms of the way I view the world.
Mm-hmm.
And thought she would have been a great president. But I just wanted to mention that I think seeing these situations only through racism is kind of a dead end, because when, if you look at the last elections, what frustrates me is, and I heard Keith Ellison mentioning this too, that we need to look for coalitions and broaden the ideas of how to work together rather than just use racism as a division. When I think about, let's say, the phrase that you toss out a lot called white privilege, I think it's important to add to that and the colossal failure of those that are underserved by our economy and minorities and women,
right.
The colossal failure to not vote, because our world would be quite different if all these folks would vote. I mean, I've been in the situation, fortunately, I can give money to causes, which I have, and I think that these, or to Congress people in other states, where I feel it's important that they win, and then they'll lose by 1 or 2%
right.
because these folks won't show up to vote. I mean, I could have a really nice kitchen if I would have spent my money otherwise. But I think it's so important that we get everybody to the polls.
I think people are waking up, B. Yeah. I mean, in the last election, which was just a few weeks ago in Ferguson, that you had 50% voting, you know, as opposed to 24%, you know, a couple of years earlier. People are starting to vote. One of the problems in communities of color is that in many parts of the United States, as many as 10% of all the men, black men, I have been through the criminal justice system. And in most of your red states, that means that they're not allowed to ever vote again for the rest of their lives. When you take 10% of a community's votes away.
Absolutely agreed. But there's still another 10% there that probably, and I understand.
Could, should
don't
vote.
Always
yeah.
have. Sure. The kind of jobs that come out of them, but certainly more than the current levels.
Yeah.
And I hate to see people just going right to, well, you know, it's because of racism, it's because of
but it is
reptilian brain.
B, it is.
But things can change if they get out and vote. But that infantilizes, I think, the fact that people can act.
Yes and no. The fact of the matter is, B, that there are poor communities in this country. When we lived in Oregon, a good friend of ours had been in prison. He was white. He'd been in prison for 2 years for meth, and he lived in Rosebud or something like this. Rose something or other, little town, white town in Oregon that is very poor and is being ravaged by meth. And in that community, you've got a much higher crime rate than you have in even, you know, some inner cities, you know, deep poverty inner cities. And yet the cops don't kill the white people.
But can you see where if we just always stop there, it's not going to, it's a dead end. It's you got to see it, check it, move forward.
I don't disagree. But, you know, you see it, check it, and do something about it before you move forward.
This is what I'm saying. But people, if all you do is just throw up, here's what I hear, folks, kind of this is what I hear in the voices. And the thing I heard Keith Ellison this morning on the radio actually saying this. This is an economic situation.
Yes.
It's the fact, you know, they're in poor areas and police are called more often in poor areas. I mean, I'm not just saying that.
No, but my point of Rose, whatever it is in Oregon, is poor areas, yes, but it's poor black areas in poor white areas. And they're here all over the United States. There are more poor white people in poverty than black people, not as a percentage of the race, but as a, you know, in absolute numbers. And yet you don't have these kind of numbers for police shootings of poor white people that you have for police shootings of poor black people. And that has to be honestly acknowledged, B.
It is honestly acknowledged, but I understand that there are, I don't have a statistic for you, but there is a police officer who is, you know, very much a liberal guy who is disputing the ProPublica numbers, just so you know.
No, I know that. But saying that it's 9 times rather than 30 times. B, Congressman Peter DeFazio just dropped on the line with us, so I'm going to have to let you go. Thank you for the call, though, and you know, good conversation. Congressman Peter DeFazio, brilliantly and ably representing the 4th District of Oregon. DeFazio, DeFazio.house.gov is his website. Congressman, welcome.
Thanks, Tom. Sorry, I was delayed. I was just over on the floor voting against the National Defense Authorization Bill, which essentially Congress has totally ducked on ISIS, Syria, and Iraq, and they gave the president a two-year blank check in the middle of this massive bill, and I find that to be outrageous.
Really? So yep. there are no congressional oversight of war, basically?
Oh, he's going to have to report monthly about what they're doing to the Armed Services Committee.
Right. Huh. Remarkable. But it's going to pass, right?
Yeah, it was passing by a pretty substantial margin.
Did they also include language in it that once again forbids the president from closing Gitmo?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Amazing. Now, you've been in the state of Oregon, the GMO labeling. I was talking to Sean, our producer, who lives in Oregon, this morning or yesterday morning, I guess it was, and she said that there's still a recount going on. They still don't know.
Yeah, there is, but our machines are pretty foolproof. The no's picked up 7, the yes has picked up 4 with 3, you know, after the first 3 or 4 counties. It's a 600, you know, over a 600 vote margin. It's not going to change.
Yeah.
But what was good, the campaign, there were a bunch of challenge ballots because we have vote by mail and they challenged people's signatures or they forgot to sign. The campaign was so well organized, they got a bunch of those people to go to, the county clerks and get their votes counted.
Hmm.
We started out a couple of thousand down and got within 600. So, it's got to be a wake up call to this industry. You've spent $100,000 now, on this. Oregon was the most expensive initiative in the history of the state, outspent the proponents 4-1. And you won by like 1/100 of 1%, and if we put it on in a presidential year, we'll win.
Right.
So.
And we will, by the way.
Yeah, that would be my preference, but
yeah.
I wasn't one of the petitioners, but yeah, I will support it again.
Yeah, remarkable. You
but
are also
threat,
on
so
the.
We got a threat that this guy from Kansas, Pompeo, he has a bill where the states' rights Republicans would preempt states' rights and say states don't have the right to require disclosure or labeling, and they're going to hold a hearing on that bill next week. I've asked to be allowed to testify, but I think they're just a little too short of time to allow me to testify.
Oh, it's incredible. How can these guys not? I don't understand how Republicans around the country, when they look at the behavior of the Republican representatives like this, where they're just selling out to these giant corporations, don't get it, how badly screwed they're being by the Republican Party. I don't get it.
Boy, I sure don't either.
Yeah.
They are trampling on, civil liberties. I mean, they're the ones who killed the minor, I would want much more major revision to the Patriot Act that Senator Leahy tried to move. So civil liberties issues, they aren't good. States' rights issues, they're not good. Certainly not, well, good on women's issues. So it is amazing to me that somehow enough people are bamboozled by watching Fox or something else to think that these Republicans care about them and their families.
Yeah. Well, even NPR this morning, I heard a report. They were talking about how many people are not covered by Obamacare. And they mentioned, in about half the states, Medicaid has not been expanded. And then the questioner just moved right along rather than
right.
saying, well, why is that?
Right.
What can we do about that?
Yeah. Republican.
No, let's not talk about that.
Well, it was the Supreme Court and Republican-dominated states because the Supreme Court
You're right.
ruled that we couldn't read.
Yeah, and they don't want to talk about either one of them.
Yeah.
Congressman DeFazio, would you like to stick around and
sure.
can you?
Yeah, yeah.
Great. Okay, hang on. We will be back with Congressman Peter DeFazio, and maybe we can even pick up some of your calls. Stick around. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And you can visit Peter DeFazio, Congressman Peter DeFazio's site at defazio.house.gov. And welcome back. Congressman DeFazio, you're still on the line with us?
Yeah, I am.
Cool. I'm curious your thoughts on and how Oregon is, or your district in Oregon, which is a largely white district, if my memory serves me correct,
are responding to the events in Staten Island and Ferguson at all. Your thoughts on all of that?
There have been some demonstrations and vigils in Eugene, a fairly substantial one in Eugene and Corvallis, and then of course up in Portland. So there is there's a strong concern at least in the university towns. I heard a lot after the Ferguson shooting about the militarization of the police, and a lot of things came out about that time. I had no idea the surplus program was giving MRAPs and things like that to little, I can't remember, one really remote Oregon county got an MRAP, and I'm like,
which
well,
is a tank,
with that?
Right?
I mean, it's not a very good off-road vehicle for, if that's what they're thinking. And we have, the president has, is taking executive action to rein in that program and make sure that what's being provided to police is more appropriate. I'll give you something that's really appropriate that's been provided. I was in Gold Beach, Oregon, little tiny Gold Beach, Oregon, one of my small, beautiful coastal cities. And, the police just, they like to hang around when I'm having town hall meetings. I was doing my August swing just to make sure there's no issues. And I looked at the chief and I said, what's that? He says, oh, that's a camera. We got video cameras. We got Homeland Security gave us a grant. So every police officer in Gold Beach, Oregon, has a video camera on any, and I said, how's it working? I said, oh, it's great. He says, there's no question in what happened and what went down when you're wearing one of these. So, I saw recently that someone is proposing, I would propose that, federal government partner with, police all across the country and get everybody these video cameras for the future.
Yeah, I agree. We brought this up a couple of days ago at some length on the program, and a number of people called in from towns where they're using the video cameras, in particular one in New Mexico, as I recall, and said that for some reason the cameras keep getting turned off whenever there's something or the data gets lost when a cop is charged with having committed a crime. And Shano, our associate producer, who's a law school graduate, suggested that much like when you get pulled over for a breathalyzer test, if you don't take it, then the presumption of innocence goes away, and now you're presumed guilty until you demonstrate you're innocent, that if a police officer turns off his camera, that same dynamic should happen. Thoughts on that?
I'm not really well, first, I'm not a lawyer, and secondly, I don't know. I mean, my it's not going to be an issue in Oregon. We get the police, these cameras, they'll use them, and they're not going to be intentionally shutting them off. Now, there can be times of failures or, you can get shot in the camera or whatever. Something could happen to it. But obviously, I would say that intentionally shutting off the camera, would be subject to, some sort of legal proceeding or disciplinary review by that force.
Yeah, you would hope. Yeah. Congressman Peter DeFazio is on the line with us. We'll be back with more of Congressman DeFazio right after this. Stick around. His website, defazio.house.gov. It's 10 minutes before you. Talk media for the rest of us. It's the Tom Hartman Program. Congressman Peter DeFazio on the line with us. DeFazio.house.gov, representing the 4th District of Oregon. And, Congressman, there's two things that I wanted to get to in my conversation with you that we haven't gotten to yet. One is apropos of this GMO story. We did this as a story both last night and today. The you and Barbara Boxer and some celebrity chefs are talking about GMO labeling. I wanted to get into that. And then I also wanted to get into you being the ranking member of the House Transportation and Infrastructure Committee and, this, 60 Minutes report, Falling Apart, America's Neglected Infrastructure. Your choice, which goes first, or if you want to talk about these topics.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Well, I'll talk about transportation first because, as you know, I think every time I'm on your show, I say we want to put America back to work. We want to be competitive in the world economy.
Yep.
We got to rebuild our crumbling infrastructure. I mean, the capital investments we made in the last century are wearing out, and we have a huge problem. We got 70,000 bridges that are structurally deficient. If I had my way, we'd post a big sign at every one of those bridges and saying, because of a lack of funds, you're about to drive over a structurally deficient bridge. Drive quickly.
Right.
See if we can get the public's attention. Actually, I don't know that the problem is with the public. I think that we could go out and talk about, I've got an idea to do away with the retail gas tax and put the tax on the oil flowing into the refinery. So maybe the oil industry will carry part of the burden. There are ways we could fund the investments we need to make. I don't know that the American public is resistant, but I sure serve with a bunch of gutless people who haven't been willing to step forward for the last 10 years and talk about what really needs to be done. We've got to rebuild this infrastructure. It's going to be expensive, but we have report after report after report. $1 billion investment, transportation infrastructure is between 28,000 and 30,000 jobs. These aren't just construction jobs. All people say, well, Congressman, I want to do construction. I say, no, hey, guess what? They're not just construction jobs. If you're doing a transit system, it's engineering, it's high tech, it's manufacturing. If you've got a small business, if you've got a minority, business enterprise, there's requirements for you, huge Buy America requirements. The multiplier factor is fabulous, and we'll get people out of congestion, stop wasting fuel, creating air pollution, and be more competitive in the world economy. Now, how about that?
Yeah, and if you want to see how it works, just look at China.
Yeah. So it's one of the few mostly bipartisan havens left on the Hill. We have our partisan disagreements. But we did one really good bill on water resources development this year, truly bipartisan, one of the only meaningful bills to pass this really lame Congress. And so I'm hopeful that dealing with the Federal Aviation Administration and 21st Century Air Traffic Control System to move people more efficiently through the skies, a surface transportation bill, an Amtrak bill. I'm hopeful we can do some real things that will have real benefit and put people back to work.
Yeah. I've always argued that, and I realize it would be a different committee because of the way Congress is organized, but that one of our most important infrastructures that has been largely ignored since the Reagan Revolution, and in fact actually went retrograde with Reagan becoming governor of California, is our intellectual infrastructure. We have people who can't afford to go to college. They can't afford to go to trade school.
Yep. During my campaign, I talked about things I had done to create real jobs, things I wanted to do that I hadn't gotten done to create real jobs, and I talked about what we're doing to our young generation in terms of the mountain of debt we're saddling them with, even in Oregon. I mean, the state has pulled so much money out of higher ed. I think 7% of the University of Oregon's budget now comes from the state. The rest of it they're raising with fees and tuition out of the students. And kids are graduating with a mound of debt, which restricts their job opportunities after college. And there was a report came out just a couple of months ago saying every year there's 450,000 young college graduates with jobs, and there's a hell of a lot of them haven't been able to get a job, who can't afford to buy a house.
Because of their student loan debt.
Their student debt.
Yeah. So they're not starting families. They're not building equity. They're not preparing for their middle years and their retirement. They're just treading water.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's a tragedy. That's investment in human capital. I mean, we should, if I had my ways, we'd have a capital budget here in Washington, and, capital would be all the normal things like infrastructure, buildings, those sorts of things, but it would also be human capital in terms of investment and education. That's something you can't short.
Yeah. No, we look around the world.
We can short it, but the results are disastrous.
Yeah, you look around the world, and everybody's doing this. I mean, even China. It's incredible. I thought this was amazing that you and Barbara Boxer did. You guys organize this thing where these celebrity chefs came to Capitol Hill and said, "We want to know what's in the genetically modified ingredients in the food that we're serving our customers."
Well, Tom Colecchio is a real activist chef. Both on hunger issues and on food safety and consumer issues. So he's not a stranger. He's been here before lobbying the Congress. He brings star power. He had Jose Andres with him and a whole bunch of other prominent chefs. And it kind of, they got a lot of foodies around here, even among members of Congress.
Sure.
It's a whole new, a whole new group of people that are raising concerns on the Hill about hunger and food safety and consumer rights in terms of the right to know what's in their food. And I think the Center for Food Safety organized the event, but it was fun. And Shelley Pingree from Maine, who has an absolutely fabulous restaurant up there, all locally sourced, she hosted an event after where Jose's staff prepared some fabulous food. So
great.
It was a great day altogether.
That's great. Yeah, everybody eats. Everybody likes to eat. Congressman Peter DeFazio, thank you for dropping by today, and thanks for the great work you're doing on the Hill, sir.
Okay, thanks, Tom.
Great talking with you. We will be back tomorrow. And thank you so much for staying with us through these 3 hours today. Don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. You can't just sit around and complain or call talk radio. You're welcome to do that, but what you really need to be doing is finding an activist on the ground group or a political party or both where you feel at home and you can exercise your activism. Tag your it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit tomhartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com. Total protection. Quicken Loans. Engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com. Your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.